Hello, everyone. Apparently, we're a bit more popular than they thought we were going to be. It's not a bad thing. My name is Glenn. I'm really happy to be here with you guys. I came here from rainy Seattle. Spent some time with folks in Belgium and Amsterdam and The Hague, and it's been really great being here. And I'm going to talk to you about what we're doing in WCF Web APIs. Just a quick story, I almost was not here. Yesterday, if you went to my session, you would have seen a nice tweet that I put on the screen, which was, scheduling fail. I was scheduled to fly out this morning. As you can see, that did not happen. So fortunately, I contacted the people that arranged for me to be here and said, a little bit of a problem, you have me presenting after I'm flying. So as you can see, they were able to fix that. And the bonus is that I get to spend a few more days here. I will now be here till Sunday, which has not made a little 6.5-year-old girl at home very happy that Daddy's gone. And apparently she woke up yesterday very excited about, Daddy comes home tomorrow. And Mommy had to say, well, that's actually not what's happening. So I guess extra toys I'll have to buy. Why am I here? What are we going to talk about? Well, we've been watching a bunch of different trends happening in the industry. Notice how I go serious now. This move from websites to web APIs. So if you look at the slide that's here on the left, you see the site, like Groupon. Do you guys have Groupon here? I hope you guys get it. It's an amazing, amazing service. I'm not happy that they don't have a Windows Phone Groupon app yet, but I still have hope. And there's Yelp, and there's all these different sites. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is this trend not moving away from sites, but also exposing APIs, allowing to go beyond the bounds of the browser to have other web applications consuming the functionality that these sites have to offer, or not even just browser-based applications. It might be an iOS application or an Android application, needing to make that those capabilities available. And we see it in social sites like you see here. So you look on the right, and a bunch of those different shots that you see are from this site called programmableweb.com. And they aggregate a listing of lots of different public APIs that are out there. And Flickr, and for example, is one of the things that is listed there. Those are only a subset of what we think actually is out there. A lot of these are socially related. And ones where they've wanted to put their presence on that page so that others can access it. But there's other kinds of uses for these web APIs. Oh yeah, almost forgot. So the nice thing about having websites and web APIs that can broadcast to all these different devices is when you're upset about something, like when I was preparing for my mix talk, you can get that maximum reach to send your message. But we've also seen, not just for social sites, other kinds of companies that are making their services available over the web. And one very recent example was Best Buy and Comcast. Best Buy went and they took their catalog system and they opened it up for third parties, not just for reading information from the catalog, but actually for doing transactional type things. And they've exposed that through a web API. In the same way, Comcast has actually been using web APIs, not so much for externals, but more for internally, for talking to devices and all types of different things. So that's one kind of trend that we've seen. The other thing we've seen is, which coincides with this, is just this move away from just PCs as the primary way to consume functionality. Everybody has a device now. How many people in here have like a smartphone or iPad or something like that? A large number. It's insane how many iPhones you see at Microsoft. Anyway, and the thing about a device though is I can't force you to use my app anymore. When it was running on a PC, I could say, yeah, you've got to go download and install my application. But when it comes to my device, I'm going to pick and choose what's there, and if I don't like the experience, I'm not going to use it. And if you don't give me something that's rich, I'm not going to use your service. Like for myself right now, I would be using Groupon more if I actually had a rich experience on my Windows phone. But because I don't, I have to go to the browser. It's not ideal. So that means that you really have to go out of your way to meet your customers by providing your services in a way that meets their lifestyle. And if you don't do that, that's just opportunity lost. You've just lost potential customers that you can get. And then we've seen this move from on-premise to the cloud, where companies are it's no longer about services just being internal within my organization. It's really about putting them out there to allow others to aggregate those services and use them. And I just came from a talk with my buddy Clemens Vasters, who did a talk on Service Bus, and he was saying how, you know, with Service Bus, or with Azure in general, and with a lot of the other services that are available in the cloud, they're all done as web APIs. They're not being done as SOAP, because they want to make them available to this large breadth of devices that are possible. So what's common to all of this, and you can see up there, is this thing called HTTP, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol. You can take any device and you can bet if it connects to the web that the minimum it understands is how to communicate over this thing called HTTP. And that is the HTTP spec. It's not new. It's been here since the web existed. It's what drives the web. But the exciting thing about HTTP is the kind of reach that it offers. Because all these devices understand it, that means I can put my functionality right into your basket, regardless of what type of device that you have. HTTP. So, in order to play in this new world, in order to build applications that really support all these types of devices that we have out there, you've got to have a platform that enables you to take rich control of HTTP. It's all about HTTP to be able to play in this world. Now, how many people here have heard of REST? Anyone want to give a definition? Right. Do you remember what that was? Set of constraints. It's a way to use HTTP for a set of benefits. HTTP guarantees you a lot of benefits, and here's why. There's a lot of servers out there that were designed to give you those benefits if you use HTTP in the correct way. And what I mean by that, and I won't get into what we talked about the other yesterday, but just a simple example would be caching. If I go to a server with a GET request, then there are intermediaries along in the middle that can say, you don't have to go all the way across the internet to that origin server that maybe is in another part of the world. I can act on their behalf. But I can only do that if you give me the ability to do that. This is kind of like the help you to help me kind of thing. If you send me a GET request, you're saying, yes, you can help me. If you don't, you're not helping me. So when we think about SOAP, everything's over post. So that's one reason why SOAP is not really good from a scalability perspective for reaching all these devices, because it means that that message has to go from point A all the way to point B. We want to achieve scale by not doing that. We want to achieve scale by making these other guys that are out there, these intermediaries, work for us. There's other problems. You might say, oh, well, GET's great. I'll just use GET all the time. And I talked about this yesterday. That's also problematic, because GET implies something can be cached, and if you use GET in a way that is actually causing a modification on the server, and we call this meaning that it's not safe or it's not idempotent, but we don't have to get into those definitions, then what happens is caches may think they can cache it, but they can't, and those caches can get poisoned. Or clients may think that because you've given me a link, it's safe for me to call GET on it as many times as I want. And I will just quote the famous example of where this caused a huge problem is when Google launched their first web crawler. They initially thought, well, every link I see is a GET. I can just follow it and call GET. Problem was, a lot of the blog engines out there had a link that meant delete. So people woke up, all their blog posts were gone. That's what happens when you don't follow the rules. That being said, it's up to you what you're going to do in terms of how you work with HTTP. I'm not going to be religious and opinionated about it, and we're not at Microsoft, but we do want people to be cognizant. It's all about trade-offs. You don't have to build a RESTful system to build something that will operate okay over HTTP, but it's all about a bunch of trade-offs. So I mentioned this idea that for you to be able to really leverage HTTP, you need a stack. You need some type of platform as a developer that's going to enable you to do that. And you might say to yourself, well, why do I need that today? Like, The web's been around forever. Everything seems to just work. Why do I suddenly need to worry about this REST thing and all these other things? And the reason is very simple. It's because in the past, your browser and the web server that your browser talked to took care of everything. But now we're doing things like where it's not just an HTML page that's getting rendered. I've got some jQuery code that's running, which is not a UI, and it's now making calls out to the server. And the browser is not getting in the middle. It doesn't know. I'm just making a request. Or maybe I have like an iOS client that's making a call. And so suddenly it's like if I'm not being intentional about, and not only that, that call that it's making is not just to a server that's serving up a web page. That call that it's making is to some type of web API that's returning some information. Well, if I'm not cognizant explicitly of how to do the right thing from an HTTP perspective, then that scale that that client is hoping to achieve, they're never going to get it. So you need a way to be able to control this. So the reason why this is becoming really important, like the last 5 years, is we're moving beyond the bounds of the browser, and suddenly a bunch of concerns that were magically just taken care of for us is no longer the case. And so Web API, WCF Web API, that's Microsoft's answer that we've been developing to provide a great solution for you being able to deliver capabilities over the web in a friendly way with HTTP, and to allow you to go as far as you would like, including if you really want to implement a RESTful system that follows all of the constraints of REST, you can do it. If you don't, we're not going to force you to do that. So you really have that spectrum there. So let's dive in and take a look at what would be the bare experience of working with the web API. And the rest of this talk, we're basically going to go through that. Cool, I have a timer. Awesome. What I want you to think about is one of the prime themes that has been driving us has been simplicity. We want to make it really easy to get off the ground and get going. So if you feel like what we're showing is not, let us know. At the same token, it's not realistic to imagine a world where everything is just so simple. Simple's great for me to get going and get started. What happens after that? So our goal here is to offer a smooth ramping experience where you can get going very quickly, do the most common things. Maybe that's even 80% of what people will do, because there's a lot of sites and APIs that will just pop up, and I just want to get something going and get it out there. But for the smaller percentage, which are probably a lot of you guys in the room, actually, that are building like real business applications, because we know that the percentage of people that will just put something on the web versus the percentage that are actually delivering like really quality, strong solutions, there's a big gap there. But for those kind of people, we want to have a good solution as well, and it's more opt-in. Okay, so let's jump in to Visual Studio. And we will create a new project. And I am just going to grab my wireless mouse to make life easier. By the way, this is one of the best inventions at Microsoft, the Arc mouse. Did it. How did that happen? Did something get hit? I didn't do anything, so I don't know. Did this get moved? What number is this supposed to be on? One? It was getting in the way of my mouse. Okay, so we're going to go create a new empty ASP.NET web application. And we're going to put it in this demo folder. And before I create the app, let's talk about what the application is going to be. What we're going to do is we're going to use a contact management application as our sample. So I'm going to have a web application that allows me to view contacts. I can modify them, view them, etc. And then I want to enable third parties also to be able to integrate with that contact management system. So I'll have browser clients, I'll have non-browser clients. So the first question anybody's going to ask when they start to work with some type of technology is just, how do I get going? And one of the things you've probably seen over and over again at this conference is talk about NuGet. NuGet is a great new package manager that we've been shipping at Microsoft, which makes it easier for you to find different types of libraries and things that you want to use without having to do an installation on your machine. It's very focused on, hey, I'm in a solution, let me go grab stuff. And in WCF, we announced at Mix with WCF Web API that we are shipping NuGet packages. And those NuGet packages, I think you'll see, make it really easy to get going. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to right-click on my contact manager, and I'm going to add a library package reference. And then I'm going to go online in the package manager. And I'm going to type webapi.all. We have about 5 different web API packages. Ooh, one or more errors occurred. That's not good. Let's try that again. There we go. So I'm going to click install. And you notice that it's pulling down a bunch of dependencies. It's telling me now, here's all the things that it depends on, the different packages, which we've broken up granularly to give people options on how they use it. One of the things you'll notice that might look interesting is the fact that we have this thing called HTTP Client. HTTP Client is a pure client-side library for working with web APIs. You don't have to use it only to talk to our backends. You could be talking to any backend. I'm going to show you that. So we're just going to accept. Okay, now the next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to pull in a model and a simple repository. And then I will show you what's there just to show you that I'm not. Let's see. So we have a contact repository. Actually, we'll just grab the models folder and the infrastructure folder, and we will copy that over. So what that just gave me was a simple, plain old C# contact object, which is going to be my model that I'm then going to be representing over HTTP. And it gave me a simple repository, which right now has some dummy data. So we got to get going. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to create a service for our contacts, and I'll just call that contact service. Now, in WCF Web API, the way that I tell WCF to care about this service is I give it an attribute called a service contract. If you're familiar with WCF in the past, we used to require you to use an interface and create separate contracts. In the web world, we're not trying to support those SOAPy type scenarios, so I just drop this right on the concrete class. And then what I'm going to do is I want to be able to retrieve contacts. So I'm going to create a method that will return a list of contact, and it will do a get. And I'm going to need access to my repository. So I'm going to create a private reference to that. For now, I'm just going to do that up here. We'll come back to that later. And now I'm going to return repository.getAll. And the last thing I need to do with my service is tell WCF what HTTP method I want to surface this over, because this is going to go over HTTP. So what we have is we have this web get attribute, and that allows you to specify a URI template with additional parameters. We're not going to use those for now, so we'll just leave it as empty. So I'm now done with my service. The next thing I need to do is host this. I've now just written the service. I need to make it available so that others will be able to access it. One of the things we heard quite a bit of feedback about was around our configuration story in WCF being a little bit complicated, you might say. And so we've really been listening. We heard a lot of feedback, and I want to show you what the new experience is going to look like. So you can memorize this pretty easily. It just takes a little bit of work. You just start off with this, and then from there, it's really easy to get going. And we made it really flexible. You can specify your browser. So if a new browser comes out, you don't have to rebuild your entire application. You can just add it. I'm just kidding. This is not what we're doing. But we have done stuff like that. We've been taking a lot of feedback that customers are saying, look, I write code. I don't want to basically be dealing with all this config stuff. And code is easy for me to deploy. In config files, I get into lots of maintenance issues. Plus, it's just non-intuitive. Code for me is intuitive. So we've been listening to that and saying, okay, if we look at some of the work like MVC's doing, they do a lot of work that starts from the global ASAX. And we've done the same thing. So we're going to go here and I'm going to add a new file. I hope you guys thought that was funny. And I'm going to choose a global.asax and then whack this other stuff that I do not need. So with MVC, when I want to add controllers, I use the route table. I add routes. And we're doing the same thing with Web API. We've introduced in .NET 4 a concept called service route. And service route is a way to say I want to work with WCF, but I'd like to integrate with ASP.NET and do it in a more seamless manner. And in our new bits, we've cleaned up the syntax a bit more. So what I'm going to do here is route table.routes.map service route, and I'm going to specify my contact service, and I'm just going to sit it at contacts. Yeah. Not contract service. Yes, that's right. Contact service, yes. Perfect. No, why did it say contact? What? Hold on a second here. Contacts. There we go. Sorry, just a rename. Say that again. Ah, thank you. Okay, so let's run this. So if I go to contacts, I now get back the result in XML. Some clients might want to talk to me in XML, but we also know that if we're doing things like with jQuery front ends, et cetera, there's another format that's very important, which is called JSON. So let's go and open up Fiddler. My internet's not working. Well, let's see. Okay. And we'll drop to our request builder. Put that URI there. And now I want to tell the server to give me JSON. Now, HTTP, the spec, has actually defined a way to do this. There's a concept called content negotiation. The richness of HTTP is that clients can say, I understand these different types of formats. It's well beyond XML and JSON, and we'll be seeing more of that throughout this demo. And the server can then say whether I can support that or not. And the way we do that is through a set of headers in HTTP called accept headers. So I'm going to go here in my accept header, and I'm going to say, give me application slash JSON. And so you can see that now the server responded and gave me JSON. But I didn't have to do anything. You know, this is talking about the get going very simply. I didn't have to explicitly tell it support XML, support JSON. It just did it out of the box with the idea that that's going to be very, very common, that people are going to want to do that. Great. So let's do this. Let's now imagine that this is a web API. We haven't built our front-end web page yet. Let's see if we can actually talk to this from a client. So there's two sides to the story here. A lot of the talks that I've been giving recently, I've been putting a lot of emphasis on the server. And somebody came to me and said, what about the client? In web API, we're actually shipping a client as well that allows you to richly work with any kind of services that are exposed over HTTP. So I'm going to show you that right now. We're going to use that in this sample. In order to do that, I need to fix the port here to 8500, I believe is the number. Now, the scenario that I'm going to show you is going to go a little bit further. It's not just going to access data over HTTP. It's actually going to do querying. One of the things that we've been developing at Microsoft, or we've helped drive, is this way of querying services called OData. Has anybody here heard of OData? So in Web API, what we're doing is we're separating out the URI format of OData from the data format of OData and saying that you can represent things any way you want to, but still take advantage of the OData query format. And later on, I'll be showing you some really interesting implications of that. But the way we enable that is, using our bits, is we just go to our service and change it from returning a list of contact to an iQueryable of contact. Now here, I'm going to go and change this to be queryable. In actuality, I wouldn't want to do that because the beauty of iQueryable is that on the server side, it won't, let's say it was querying against a database, it won't actually issue the database query as long as I return just a queryable until the two queries have been composed. You came in and did a filter, like give me only the top three, and it will apply that, and because a queryable is more of a lazy execution, it will ultimately result in a SQL statement going to the database, if I was using SQL or whatever database I was using, that only has the filter that I specified, rather than loading the whole thing into memory. In this example here, I already have an in-memory repository with about 10 entities, so I'm not gaining much by making it go in a lazy manner. But what I want you to see is what that translates into in terms of the queryability side. So I'm now going to go add an existing solution that we'll jump into. Which is up one. Where is it? Oh, demo. There we go. Queryable sample. And this is set to use that same port that I was just showing you. So I'm going to go here to my properties of my solution, and I'm going to set it to use multiple startup projects because I want both to run. So this is that third-party consumption that we're about to go through now. I've got one website, and that website is actually going to consume data coming from this web API. And that's this queryable sample. So I'm going to set my startup project and run. Say a little prayer. Okay. Now the first thing, I'm also going to add a breakpoint so you can see that we're actually coming through that service that we created, which is our contact service. And I'm just going to put a breakpoint here. Say get all contacts. Maybe I put, oh, there we go. But why didn't it break? That's a question. Oh. Thank you very much. I thought I was, though, didn't I? Let me go check that again. Start. Didn't say start without debugging. Oh, it didn't. It did a single startup. Okay. That's why. It ran the... I changed it back when I did the right-click start on project. That's why. All right. Let's try it again. If that's the least of my demo issues, I'll be very happy. Okay. Will you go away, please? Thank you. There we go. So I've called get all contacts. We can see it's going through. And now it's giving me back all contacts. That's kind of interesting, but I could do that before. There's no queryability there. Let's try get top three contacts. We can turn this off because we now see it works. So take a look at the URI there. I'm specifying a top query of three. So I'm saying give me back the first three results. I can do other things, like get me the fifth contact. There I'm using skip. So all these different operators that OData has defined as part of the OData spec will be supported. We're not going to support expansions, at least not initially. And then with this, I can also do like get me the particular ID. So I can say get me contact ID of 8. There is no contact ID of 8. That's worked. That's good. Get me contact ID of 7. I can see I get back my buddy Ron Jacobs. Now, that's all worked with XML, but guess what? That also works with JSON. And if you see on the bottom, you can see that I'm showing as the query happens, what is the wire format. How I do that is also quite interesting. So let's switch to that. So we've seen how the server works. We've seen that it was pretty simple, I think, to get going. XML JSON worked out of the box. iQueryable was simply just a turn on by changing my return value to be iQueryable. How does that look to you guys? Okay. Let's take a look at the client code. Warning, the client code is not as pretty the way it has been written. It has nothing to do with the code itself, or with our APIs. So I mentioned that we have this new thing called an HTTP client. So if we look at the get all contacts and we go to this get client method, you'll see that I'm creating a new HTTP client. And once I have that HTTP client, I can then go and send requests using that client and get back responses. Now, we talked about how with HTTP, it's all about getting access to all that information that the request and the response contain so that you can manipulate HTTP in a proper way. So if you look here, like when I call get top three, I actually have a nice response object that lets me drill into the headers in a strongly typed way so I can access all the information that I need to, but I can still get objects. So if you look here, I'm for-each-ing through the response, which I know is going to be able to be represented as a particular collection of objects. And we've actually made that pluggable. You can go here and supply your own formatters, which we'll get into in a minute, which you can actually use on the server as well. Fully symmetrical model here. Yes? In this case, I copied it. Doesn't matter. I mean, there's nothing, you could share it or not. You could put it into a library. We actually have another cool thing, which might break, but let's see if I can at least show it working for you, is we have a new type that we've introduced in the framework called JSON value. And what JSON value allows you to do is if I know, but it only works if I'm working with JSON. It's a dynamic way to work with JSON. And the reason we did this is a lot of customers have said to us, hey, when I'm working in JavaScript, I don't need to define these static classes. I can just get some JSON back, turn it into an object, and start accessing it. And so what we're doing is, thanks to the dynamic keyword that we introduced to the framework in 4.0, which brought dynamic capability to .NET, we're leveraging that with a new type called JSON value. You can use JSON value on the client or on the server, and it allows you to just access JSON in a loosely typed way. You guys want to see a demo of that? Okay. So we'll come back to this one. We'll just open another instance of Visual Studio. This was not planned, but I have a sample, so it's fine. And I have like 8 gigs of RAM, so Visual Studio, why are you taking a long time? Okay. I do have an SSD. I love SSD. I don't have to sit here having a heart attack, like, why is my hard drive spinning so fast? What the heck are you doing? It may still be doing stuff now, but I don't see it, so I don't worry about it. Okay, so this is our JSON value sample, which I'm going to include, and I'm going to take this out. Where is it? Come on. Okay. I'm going to unload that. Yeah. It's a very simple sample, but it will show how this works. Hopefully. Yes. So I get a simple screen where I can add a name. So I'm going to add a name like Mark. And click Add. It says contact created, Mark, contact ID equals 1. Let's see what's happening, though, on the server. That doesn't look so special. But it is. Looks can be deceiving. So if we look at this now on the server here, my post is actually getting what's called a JSON value. It's not getting a type. I'm not getting a contact. I'm getting a JSON value, which I'm then setting internally to be a dynamic because it implements dynamic. The reason why I can't just pass this as dynamic is we assume if you just give us a single parameter that's an object or dynamic, right now at least, then you want to get access to the request. So we just automatically plug in the request object, and then you work with that as a dynamic object. That's why I can't return this way, but we may look at a way to make that simpler. So I get this JSON contact, I cast it as dynamic, and now I'm going to create another dynamic object to return, which is called JSON object. And now I'm accessing contactResponse.name equal to contact.name. This is adding a new property to the return. Both name and contact ID don't exist when I new up JSON object. So because it's dynamic, I'm just setting it, and it's coming into existence. And then it's returning out as JSON. Now, things to think about is there's a trade-off when you go down this path. This path is for people that just want to work with JSON. They're used to working with JavaScript on the front end and say, I want the same experience on the server. You will not be able to use this to return XML and JSON from the same method like I showed you we were able to do before. But that doesn't make it invalid. It's good if your scenarios match. For example, if you're using jQuery, which we're going to now switch to jQuery, this will work absolutely fine for a jQuery front end. And even if you have some web APIs, but they're only talking JSON, that will work fine. Make sense? Yeah. You want to set the content type? Good question. So you mean, so I can set what it is, you mean? JSON value itself is modeled over JSON. Are you saying so that I could use this and still work with XML? Yeah, this type won't support that. What we could do in the future is maybe make it that you just pass dynamic, and the dynamic that we give you knows how to deal with XML or JSON. This one is very specific. That you could do. That you could do, but what you would have to change the URI today. It won't automatic. There's no way to automatically route between the two. So we have a great story for supporting multiple formats off the same method, what you're mentioning, and it's something we've thought about. It sounds like is saying, I want to have two different methods, same URI, and based on content negotiation, either the JSON one or the XML one. Is that what you're asking for? Please go to CodePlex and put that work item, and other people can vote on it. We do have a CodePlex website, by the way, wcf.codeplex.com, if I don't get to talk about it. So that is showing you how our JSON support, the JSON support that we give you if you want to work just directly with loosely typed objects. Any questions on this before I move on? Let's jump back then to our other sample because we have more interesting things to show. So in the current sample, we've seen consuming XML JSON from the back end. What we've not seen yet is if the client is a browser. And the browser gets interesting because there's some new problems that we're going to have with the browser. So let's go and make this. We can get rid of our queryable sample, actually, which we'll leave it there. It doesn't hurt, I guess. But we'll change it so it's not starting up. So I have pre-created a few things which we will show. I have a jQuery front end web page that can consume our contact information. And what's interesting about it, if you haven't really looked at jQuery, one of the really fascinating things about jQuery, and did I post it in the right place? Yes, I did. These are the jQuery scripts, is it opens up the opportunity to have client-side browser-based applications. Ajax has opened this up for a while, but jQuery really brings it to fruition, where the server is doing nothing more than serving up a static page that then runs some client-side script to interact with the server from that point on, which is very interesting from a web API perspective because it could be the web API as the thing that it's talking to. So let's see that. So I just went and dropped in, as I mentioned, some jQuery. That's jQuery if you haven't seen it. And what this is saying is that when this document loads, go and fetch from the contacts URI the contact information. So there we go, some contacts in jQuery, pulling back from my server. But now I want to add a contact. So that's a little bit of a challenge right now because we've shown XML and JSON working. If all we support is XML or JSON, that's going to put a burden on my client to now have to parse the web page and encode information into JSON or into XML to send it. If I'm on a mobile device, that might not even be possible, depending on the device. I can be sure that it will understand how to render HTML. And there's another thing that I can be sure of. If it understands HTML, it understands HTML forms. Well, HTML forms introduce yet another media type. It's not just XML and JSON. There's another one called form URL encoding. And form URL encoding is how, whenever you click post on a form, that's how that information goes back. It's either going to be posted or it's going to be as a GET, and you should use POST if you're going to make any changes to the server. If you're just doing like a search, which those intermediaries can act on behalf and give you back the results, then you do a GET. In either case, though, it's still going to get encoded in form URL encoding, either in the URI or in the POST body. So in order for this to work, A, we need to have a POST. We don't have a POST yet. And B, we need to be able to support form URL encoding. Let's do that. So we're going to go back to our contact service, and now we're going to need to add a method that accepts a contact, and we'll make it return the contact as well. So we'll call that method post. And we will call our repository with post, putting the contact in. Now we need to tell Web API to expose this as a post. And the way we do that is We have a method called WebInvoke, attribute called WebInvoke that can be used for anything but GET. You can even use it for custom HTTP methods or options or whatever's out there. So I'm going to say the method equals post, and the URI template still is empty in this case because I'm posting to a collection resource. And let's put a breakpoint there. And let's run. And there were build errors. What did I do wrong? Ah, thank you. It's great that I have you guys paying attention. You'd think after this being about the eighth time I've done this that I would... All right. Oh, well. Retrospective. There's actually supposed to be an image there while it loads. I'll show you how that works. That's using Ajax, and there's a little spinny thing, but I didn't paste it in the images folder, so that's why you're not seeing it. So now I'm going to put Mark, and I'm going to click Add. We can see that I hit my post method. Great. That worked. But I mentioned this form URL encoding thing. So IE actually has this dev toolbar because my Fiddler is not working right. So let's set it to start capturing. And let's go add. Well, we can add Mark again. This one doesn't enforce anything. So we'll click Add again. Put that breakpoint there. We can see that the content type, form URL encoded. And if we look at the body, there it is. That's the form URL encoded body. So what we're seeing here, again, going back to the ramp up, remember, I've not had to touch any configuration of Web API yet. I've simply just out of the box been able to say, I can do XML, JSON, form URL encoding. And I can do that OData query format by adding on the iQueryable. You see that nothing broke, even though I'm doing other kinds of things that are not related to that querying. It also still works. So this is what we mean when we say that we're focused on the ramp-up experience. This is the ramp-up experience. So let's start to go a little bit further. HTTP has some very clear semantics. It's not that are defined and rules, and you can find them in the HTTP spec. And one of them says that when I do a post, I should return one of two status codes, a 201 or a 202. In WCF, Web API by default, we're going to just return 200. Maybe we should change that, but still, the intent of whether it's a 201 or a 202, really that's up to you. It's based on your logic. A 201 means that it's been created. A 202 means it's accepted. Think of it as more like a queue, like it's there and we know it's there, but we haven't done anything with it. And you would poll after that point to find out whether or not that has been removed, in which case then you would know that it was actually handled. But the challenge here is I need a way to set that status code, just like I may need to access headers and other kinds of things. But we'll start with the simple case. So the question is, how do I do it? And in the past, we've allowed this, but when we've allowed it, the code has gotten really ugly. It's been static APIs. Any of you have heard of a class called Web Operation Context in WCF? Only the guys that work at Microsoft. Okay, good. Well, you'll just have to trust me. So let's just then focus on what it looks like. So what I want to do is I still want to return a contact because I want that benefit of being able to support all these different formats plus more, but I would like to access some headers or status or whatever. So what we're doing is we're introducing a new type called HTTP response message of T. You already saw the response actually on the client when I did that request with the queryable sample. I showed that we're taking those same types and you'll be able to use those on the server. Once I have that, I can now change, instead of returning a contact, I can new up a new HTTP response message of contact, passing in my contact instance, And then on the response, I can just access the status code. So I'm going to set the status code to created. Now, I might also want to do something like this, because the other part of the semantics of post is I should return a location header. Because the way post works, I haven't told you what the URI is going to be. The server is in control to say to me, okay, the thing you just created, it's located over here. So you're supposed to also return that location information. So if I go into headers here, you'll see that I have in my response a location, and I can set that location to a URI, and the URI in this case will be contacts, let's say contacts/1, because even though you posted to contacts, I've decided that for the individual entities, you're going to go to contact. That's up to you. Some might decide to just keep it under contacts. We're not opinionated. Great. So I'm going to set that to that, and I'm going to set it as relative. So URI kind relative. And now I'm going to return that response. Oh, yeah. That's why it's not compiling. I'm just really looking to see if you guys are on your P's and Q's. And you're winning shining awards right now. So let's go again. Okay. And let's... This is one thing that annoys me, is that you have to explicitly start capturing. It's like if I open the dev bar, I want to capture. I usually want to capture, but I don't know. Maybe not, because you can also browse the dome. Okay, so we'll go again and do mark. Click add. Did that go through? I don't think it did. Let's try it again. Yes, that did. And now if we look down here, well, we can see it got 201. So I had that ability to mess around with the response before it went back. And not only that, but I can also drill in, and I will see that it set my location header as well. So if we look at our response headers and scroll down, there we go, location. So this is just stepping up a level. Now, you could do the other way and just return objects and things like that. You're not necessarily following the rules of HTTP, but it works. Now, as you start to get more into things that require you to make decisions, you have the ability to do that. Yes?
By using the post, will that avoid cache portioning? So
caches ignore post. Caches don't affect... So what happens is that with cache... So the question is, if I'm using post, the first question was, will it somehow affect the cache? Posting never affects caches, because caches don't look at post, they look at get. That's why you never have to worry about SOAP getting in the way, because everything is over a post. You use these headers to give information. So when I return something, so in that response, I could supply some caching information. Then when that response comes back, servers can look at that response. They're not looking at the thing that was posted itself. So I send back that header information, and that header information will say like what the caching policies are, like what the expiration is, but the client will use that as well. Like if I have a browser, I send back an expiration policy that says this can live for 5 minutes, then the next time I query on that browser, it will actually just use what's in the cache. So that's the kind of communication that happens. But yeah, whenever gets happen, responses from servers do get cached. It's the thing that's sent. Actually, that's not true. Let me take that back. The post response will not get cached. Get responses get cached. Because the post response can't get cached, because it's happening as a result of some work on the server, it might change at any moment. So a GET request is what's cached. So that was improper what I said. You can still return headers, though, and those headers will get used by, like, the browser if you want to. You can say, I've posted, you've posted, yes, but the result that you got back, I'm telling you, because I'm in the position to do it, that this has a caching policy of 5 minutes. And then the browser can work with that. So the caching has, so the question was, I've got a collection and now that collection changed. The way we solve this problem is what are called e-tags. And e-tags are that a server can return you an e-tag that says, this is a GUID, this is a unique identifier that, and it's a header. We can look here, you'll see headers.etag. This ID represents the snapshot of what I gave you at that point in time. And then what you can do is called a conditional GET. And with a conditional GET, and your browser understands this automatically, with a conditional GET, I send that e-tag along as part of an if match. There's a set of special headers that you use. And you say to the server, this is the ID that I have for this particular resource, the e-tag. Is this still valid? And the server can return to you saying it's not modified. And now what you've done is you haven't passed the entire entity across the wire. You've only had this small bit of headers that go across the wire. And that's the way caching fully works, is that way. So that allows collections and other things to work fine, because what will happen is when I take that e-tag and go back for that collection and it has subsequently changed, the server will send me back a status code that will indicate that it's no longer valid, that e-tag is no longer valid. So that's how that works. Yeah, caching is a deep discussion. And our thing here is just to enable you to be able to do those sorts of things, because for some scenarios, it's very, very important. Lots of banks, lots of different systems, Best Buy, they're going to utilize caching because it's saying, look, if I've got hundreds of thousands of people looking at my catalog at the same time and those items don't change that often, I don't want them to unnecessarily be barraging my servers with requests for things that are already there. Does that make sense? Okay. So the next question, the next thing we'll get into is the question of testability. So right now, we've got this class here, and we've got this dependency that's getting pushed in. And we also have these messages here. We want to be able to run different types of tests that check, was the status code set to created? Was the location set properly? Because that's all functionally requirements of my system. They may be requirements of my system that are imposed on me from HTTP, but they're still requirements of my system nevertheless. It'd be great if I can validate that. Right now, I'm newing up the repository. So that makes it difficult for me to test if that was a real repository. What I'd like to actually be able to do is something like this. I'd like to go and say, I contact repository, and then set my repository equal to that repository. That's what I would like to do. But in order to be able to do that, Web API has to know at runtime when this thing gets created where that repository is going to come from so that in a unit test, I could give it a fake one. And this is what IOC containers are all about. So in Web API, we want to make it easy for you to be able to do testability. And so let's do that. So the first question when you're going to start to work with an IOC container is, which one? I have a preference that I like. We're not going to be opinionated. You can use whichever one you want to. What I'm going to use is my friend Nick's AutoFac. Anybody here use AutoFac or heard of AutoFac? Anybody here use IOC containers? Okay, a few. Good. Okay, so I'm going to install AutoFac. And then I'm going to jump back to my global.asax, where for now we've just been using it to configure routing information. And I'm going to do something a little different. So the first thing I'm going to do is I need to configure AutoFAC, and I'm not going to have you sit here and watch me do that. So thanks to the power of snippets, that would be contact service. So that is not web API code. That's a third-party library that I've just configured, and I've told it I want to add my contact repository as an iContact repository, which will allow that to get plugged in through the constructor, and I want it to find my contact service and register that as well. Great. But now I have to tell WCF about that. That's the challenge. How do I tell WCF to use AutoFAC or whatever IOC that I want to use, Castle Windsor, whatever it is, doesn't matter. So what I'm going to do is I have this HTTP host configuration class, and I'm going to say var config equals HTTP host configuration dot create. And what you're going to find then is a Fluent API. And that Fluent API is going to surface to you what are the kinds of things you can do to configure further your service. And it's doing it in code. So if I look down, I will see that there is a thing called a resource factory. And the resource factory is what allows me to say that when you're going to create services or resources, use this, use my IOC. So what I'm going to do now is I can either provide it a class implementation of iResource Factory, or I can use a Lambda expression. So I'm going to use that. So I have a type, an instance, and a message here. And I need to return an instance. So I'm going to return container.resolve, and I'm going to pass it my type. And the second Lambda expression that I have is for releasing the instance. And I'm not going to do anything there because I don't need to. And I'm just going to put a semicolon there. And then let's go put a breakpoint in our repository to show that, no, not in our repository, in our service, to show that it actually gets the right repository instance. And we're not done yet. It will not work if I do this because I haven't passed in that configuration information. So my route has a parameter when I call this map service route where I can pass in a configuration class like the one that I just configured. Just a side note, this is more of a script inline style of configuring to make it easy. If you wanted to, you can derive from that HTTP host configuration class and move that inside of a reusable class that you use, say, without your company, a centralized class. Others can derive from it if they want to, and you set your policy once. Or even you as a developer, you just write your own and say, well, whenever I build my applications, I just use this because it has my types of settings that I want. It's also interesting because you might want to enable certain types of behaviors in a debug mode that you wouldn't want to. When you're deploying, you can do all that very nicely with just code now instead of having to bend yourself into some configuration markup language. So with all this done, when I say all this, should just work. Okay, so if we look and hover over, we see that we got an instance of our contact repository. Make sense? Now, I said this is testable. And here's why I can say that. Well, first off, I've been able to test my own code because I can stub out things. These classes down here, these HTTP response message classes and HTTP request message, and by the way, just for completion so you know it, I can also do this. HTTP request message of contact if I want to access the request headers that are coming in. You can do both. Those are just dictionaries of information, strongly typed wrappers of dictionaries. They don't have any dependency on the runtime, on WCF being set up, which means I can nicely just create them in a unit test, write tests that validate that the result is what I expect it to be. I'm not going to write that code in front of you, but I have it pre-written. So I'm going to go add another project here, which will be my contact manager tests. And I'm going to get rid of that. And add a reference to my contact manager. And let's take a look at our tests that we have here. So that needs to be not that. It shouldn't be that. Yeah. Why did I change the name of that to contact service? Every demo I've done has been contact resource. I'm a glutton for pain. All right, let's just fix them up. Yes, I know I could do search and replace. I'm stubborn. All right, so let's look at the tests we have here. Now, here I chose to use a mocking framework. The nice thing about me having that repository now be an interface is I can mock out that repository for my unit test. So here you can see that I've mocked my iContact repository using mock, which is the framework that I'm using, but there's a ton of different mocking frameworks, or you could hand roll mocks if you want to. I'm setting it up to return the name that I'm expecting, and then I'm just checking that, hey, when getting contacts resource, then contacts are returned. Let me just run the test to show you they all run, and then we can show what see what they are. Oh, one of them may fail. Let's see. Does it? Nope, they all succeeded. Good. So I proved to you that it is testable. And if we look at the code, you'll notice I'm not newing up. I'm not creating any hosting or anything. Just simply newing up that service like a class, hitting on it and seeing does it do what it's supposed to do. And the real interesting one, I think, is this one. Because this is the one that needs to be able to get access to HTTP to see was the status code set to what I expected it to be. And I did that very easily here because I simply was able to take back the response that I got, check the created to see that it check the status code, see that it matched created. Make sense? Cool. Let's move on. That's been just the beginning. We've seen about three different media types. We've seen the importance of having all these different formats. And we saw a basic experience for getting going. And we just saw a little bit of flexibility that I could go and look at the headers or play with the headers, etc. But a flexible framework is one that lets you go as far as you want to go or doesn't just stand in your way. And that's been a driving philosophy for us, that we want you to get the flexibility. And what I thought was funny about this is there's a line right there that says that new all-steel front acts as a shock absorber. And what I thought about when I read that is, you know, you work with a framework or a library, and it's really easy to do the things it says it can do out of the box. But that experience, the first time you have to step outside of that, can be shocking. It could be like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? It might even cause you to want to unroll using that framework at all because you realize, hey, the simple things are simple, but in reality, I know I'm going to do more complicated things. So we've been thinking a lot about that. You just saw a bit of it. And that relates very heavily to this concept of formats. So I just showed you three, JSON, XML, and form URL encoding. But reality, there's a lot of different formats. And those formats are there for specific purposes. You use a particular format because the consumer understands it and you want to have a certain kind of experience, a richer experience. For example, when I send a form, the server understands the semantics of that form and to pull out those values and use them for representing what I'm trying to do. If I send back an image, the client knows, ooh, that's an image. I know how to represent that. I don't want to show you just bytes. I want to show you a graphical representation. If I give you something like Atom, Atom has very rich semantics around feeds. It's not just some data. It actually has feeds and feed items. And because the media type, the content type, is application/Adam, instantly 10,000 different clients who've never even seen my application before know how to work with it. That's not what happens with XML and JSON. All XML and JSON say is, I'm parsable. A parser can read me. I need to know very specifically as a client what thing I'm calling against, what I'm expected to get back. You could give me a schema. Even the schema is only going to tell me what the definition is. Adam is much more than definition. It actually tells me that this is a feed, and this feed has feed items. And if I'm doing Adam Pub, these feed items can be edited. There's a whole bunch of very rich semantics buried in those media types. And this is where REST gets very interesting versus the WSDL conversation of SOAP, where SOAP gives you a very static definition that only relates to the signatures of methods. It doesn't have any semantics attached to it. Turns out, though, there's many, many more media types than you see here. As a matter of fact, there's this website called IANA, the Internet Naming Authority, and that's where all these public media types get registered. And I went to that site and looked under the application media type section, which you can see here. And you see all of them have these RFCs associated with them, which is also interesting, because by having an RFC, that's where I get to define what are the semantics. What does Adam actually mean when you see it? So I went and scrolled and scrolled and scrolled and scrolled and scrolled and did a calculation, and there's about 900 application media types just in the application section of IANA, which means there's actually thousands. And when I saw that, I went, But the reality of it is, you can relax, and I can, it's not actually a bad thing. Each of these media types is for a very specific purpose. But if you're talking to a client that understands one of those, you can meet that client further. You can have a richer type experience. I'll give you one example. One, we've shown this sample of contact management. So imagine another system, like we showed that example of the iQueryable. That's just querying some data. It's still not giving the client any rich information about what it got back other than, hey, it's parsable and it's also queryable. But there's a media type called vCard, text/directory. And what that is an electronic way to express a business card. And there are tons of systems out there that understand vCard. Well, if I can make my contact management APIs talk vCard, then I can have a much richer experience with those clients that don't know about XML and JSON, but they do know about vCard. I can push them contact information in a very rich way. Another type of format, which we've already talked about, is the Open Data Protocol. The Open Data Protocol is a way to query data, but the representation that comes back also has a set of semantics, that these are elements that have relationships, and it really kind of relates to a database. It doesn't necessarily have to. It relates to an entity model. So if I can support OData, then an OData client like PowerPivot can talk to my resources, which a lot of business analysts like the idea that I can pull this into Excel and analyze that information, that data. We're probably starting to run out of time, or are we out of time? How much time do we have left? 1 minute and 33 seconds. Oops. Okay, so I'm going to try to show you two demos in lightning-fast time. But I'm not going to be having to write code, so that's why it's achievable. So one of the things that we've done, because we realize how important these formats are, and how this is so different than SOAP, because SOAP was the one format to rule them all that, again, didn't have these rich semantics. But we look outside and we look at the web and we look at all the systems that are out there. It's really about being able to support whatever formats you want to support, not that you have to support all the thousands that exist. So we're introducing a concept called formatter. And formatters are ways of saying, I want to support some different type of representations. So if we look here, in that same Fluent API, I actually have a method called addFormatters. And here I'm adding a bunch of new formats. Beyond XML, JSON, form URL encoding, I've got a PNG formatter. I've got a feed formatter for OData. I've got a vCard formatter for returning contacts. And I have a calendar formatter for returning iCal. Let's see a few of those. And the one we really want to see is the V-card one. So the first thing I had was an image formatter. So that's the same resource that's returning my data. But because I've been able to plug a custom formatter in, I've been able to say, based on the media type that was asked for, and in this case, the browser by default doesn't set, it sends image, PNG, as higher up in its requested types of content than it does, say, something like XML. So image takes precedence. So by doing that, I was able to plug in a formatter on the server that says, I want you to take that and turn it into an image. Can I keep going for like two more minutes? And if we jump very quickly just to see that working, this is actually getting a contact instance. So we're just letting you sit in the middle and say, here it is, do what you want with it. I have a stream. That stream is the output stream. So I'm going to write to that output stream an image. I have a library of images on a folder system somewhere. I'm going to use the ID, if you look at the logic here, and then just write out the image. Cool. Why that's important is because media types are well beyond just markup. They can be anything. It can be a video. It can be a photo. It can be a PDF. It can be lots of different things. I could go to a resume site and get a PDF, which will be the actual resume, not an HTML representation. And HTTP already provides all the richness for me to be able to do that. But I showed you iQueryable before, but what I didn't show you was OData. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to my contacts, and I'm going to say top equals 3. But instead of going to my contacts, I've done a little trick on the server that allows me to have sub-resources, which will map to an actual content type. In this case, I'm going to map OData to application/atom+XML. And when I do that, it fails. And that's because I don't have a question mark. So now I got back OData, which is very different than just XML or JSON. Last one I want to show, and then I'll let you guys get out of here, is the V-card. Because the V-card one is really, really interesting. And the reason it's interesting is because, like the image, which is very different than XML or JSON, the V-card is not XML or JSON. As a matter of fact, iCal also is not XML or JSON. So I'm going to go into Fiddler here, go to my request builder, and I'm going to go to contacts again. And I'm even going to use my queryability that I get, top equals 3. I'm going to change my accept header, though, to be text/directory. That is the MIME type or the media type for a V card. So now I'm going to execute that. You can see I got back a V card, which is a very different format. Now comes the sweet spot. What can I actually do with that? I promise this is the last thing I show. Let's go to Gmail. Why is this significant? Because, hey, we've got OData, which is a nice format for data, but here we're talking in the domain of contacts. And there's pre-existing formats. So Web API is about supporting pre-existing things, not just new things that you can create. So I'm going to log in using my Gblock demo. Unfortunately, at Mix, I logged in with my real one, and people saw my emails and my contacts. It was not great. Let's see if I remember the password. Hold on. That will be bad. Yes. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to go to my contacts here. And they're already... Are they cleared? Is it working?
It's loading.
Oh, my network cable came out. Sorry. It doesn't stick in. They're designed to stick. Come on. Come on. Ah, this is not fair. Hold on. I don't know what it's doing. It's locking up. All right, we got it. So I'm going to delete these. Just so you can see that I'm not faking this. And what I can find is, over here I have import contacts. And look at that. It says it understands vCard. So if I go back to Fiddler and copy this URI, notice I've included the query with it. I can go and paste this because the file system, Windows file system, actually understands URIs when you use the HTML file picker. So I'm going to say import. Oops. What did I do? Let's try that again. Oh, I know why. It's because I need the headers are not going to get sent by the browser when I go and browse the file system because it's looking for a file. And that's why I've set it up on the server to allow me to pass in extensions. So if I go to contacts/VCF, I've told the server I want you to use the text directory media type. I won't have time to show you how that's done, but you can hook in to do these types of things, which further shows the flexibility. And I will add it to a new group, my contacts, and click import. We've imported 3 contacts. So that's what vCard allowed me to do. So thank you guys very, very much. You can get all this stuff at wcf.codeplex.com. We are in development, but we're sharing the source as we go. This is going to be an add-on to .NET 4, so you can download it now. You don't have to install anything. You just get a bunch of samples and other stuff, and you can start to work with it. And also, we have the NuGet packs, which you can find at NuGet, which will help you get going really quickly. If anybody wants to ask questions or whatever, I'm here. Thank you very much.